This podcast is for informational purposes only. We are not medical professionals and do not provide medical advice. Consult a healthcare provider for any health concerns. Opinions expressed are not a substitute for professional medical guidance.
This edition of the Optimize We podcast is brought to you by the Biohacking Index. Visit biohackingindex.com for ratings and reviews of your favorite wellness solutions and wellness providers. Hello and welcome to the Optimize We podcast, where we share biohacking truths without the BS. I am joined today by an amazing young lady. Her name is Dr. Kathy Campbell. She is not only a trailblazer in her Western medicine area of industry, but she's also taken a huge leap into unknown, uncharted waters in helping people live their life to the fullest potential naturally. So welcome to the show, Dr. Kathy Campbell. How are you today?
Thank you, Lindsay. I'm really well. Thanks for having me.
So you've done a lot of cool things in your career, and I'm not going to try to make you sound old, but we were just talking about how you went to school with the best typewriter.
Yeah, I did.
Now, you've seen a big transition in the world over the last several decades. Why don't you tell me a little bit about your background and how you got to the place where you are today?
Sure. I am trained as a pharmacist. And so I'm a community pharmacist. And I started my career in 1992 coming out of school. I actually had a bachelor's degree in pharmacy and a bachelor's degree in zoology for things. So I had a dual bachelor's. And I love science. I'm kind of a science geek. I'm also a problem solver. But I particularly love science that, when applied, makes a difference for people's quality of life, right? Because ultimately, I want you to have a great life. So I came out of school. I'm in Oklahoma. I grew up in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Came back because my parents were a little older. And I said, well, if I'm going to have a relationship with them, I'm coming back home. And I started my career in a suburb of Tulsa called Owosso, Oklahoma. And at the time, there was about 10,000 people in our town. There's about 45,000 now. But I started at a community grocery store serving patients, right? And doing what I do and just absolutely love that hands-on relationship that position actually provided, and started learning my craft. So I've stayed in Owosso for now 33 years as a pharmacist. I have relationships, deep therapeutic relationships, patients now for four generations, okay? And about 25 years ago, I had the opportunity, the universe, God gave me the opportunity to start my own pharmacy. And I have always kind of done things a little different in that I wanted clinical autonomy. I wanted to do what I wanted to do with my patients. I'm a really good employee, but once I stepped into my own employment, I had the freedom to do what I wanted to do for patients. And I had to figure out what that was. And what I decided was, I want you to have a great life. And health is foundational to that. And I know that as a pharmacist, I am trained with unique insights and unique skills to facilitate that. And so that four generations relationships had me study patients, love patients. And I didn't like the progression of what I was seeing, that they were aging in a way that required more and more medicines, or I could see that the medicines were causing harm and nobody was really saying anything about that. Mm. And medicines only work as an adjunct to diet and exercise. And nobody was talking about that. Yeah. And I had a personal journey with obesity.
I was going to say, so you're treating the patients, but you're also the patient yourself.
Always. I mean, that is where all, I think, evolution and transformation and innovation lies, especially if you look at the functional medicine whole milieu of how that's changed. You always have a personal crisis, or in the family, or a child, or yourself that nobody could quite figure out. And so it required a deep dive, just like in your story, it required deep dives. And so that deep dive that my family's obesity, I was 100 pounds at 5 years old in 1972. There weren't very many 100-pound five-year-olds in 72.
Wow.
And I had a 350-pound grandfather in the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. So there was something about our journey that didn't fit the narrative.
Right.
It didn't fit the science mm-hmm. at the time. My blood work was healthier than any thin person around. So it always had me go, there's something else, and to study it. Plus, being able to study my patients and have that deep relationship with them to learn from them and their trust to try things from me has led to just a remarkable practice. And I'm an equal opportunity biochemist, basically. As a pharmacist, we're trained in chemistry. I don't care if that chemistry is a vegetable, which is incredibly complex chemistry, or if it's ultra-processed food, or if it's a supplement, or if it's quantum biology. I'm going to try to apply all of that equally, or if it's a pharmaceutical, I'm going to apply that to get that great life for patients.
Now, I was going to ask you about that because, you know, you did a TEDx story. Being a TEDx speaker myself, I know how hard it is to get up there and tell your story. The big chunk of my story wasn't a vulnerable story. Yours is extraordinarily vulnerable, where you talk about your journey with obesity. Being 100 pounds at 5 years old is an incredible thing that needs to be, as you said, dove in deeper to.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of us these days, we don't dive in deep into the science and the research. We're not asking ourselves why. We're asking ourselves, how do I get rid of this weight as quickly and as easily as possible?
Right.
And so there's a huge wave of people of all ages, not just older people who are having a lot of comorbidity issues, heart disease and cancers and other stuff from obesity, but are also going on in younger generations, maybe not at 5 years old, but maybe at 15, where they're going in for Ozempic or some sort of semaglutide or, you know, the GLP-1s of the world. So what was your journey like? Give us a little, you know, micro TEDx. How did you
go
get yourself out of the obesity cycle? And then also, what are you seeing now from your patients?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I appreciate it. And I'll see if I can tease it out. So I was very fortunate in my journey because I was fat in a fat family. Mm-hmm. And we loved ourselves. And we knew there wasn't the psychological shame being obese. And we didn't stand out amongst ourselves. So I was very fortunate that I was loved and accepted by the people I needed to be loved and accepted by as my identity grew. Okay. Nice. And so it's huge. It was huge. It set a tone for, yes, you're overweight. Yes, it's something you should pay attention to and work towards being healthy. But We're good. I remember once there used to be a brand called Mr. Bubble, and it was a bath soap, and there was a commercial that came on in the 70s, I think it was, and it was a bunch of people in these big pink bubble costumes singing Mr. Bubble tune, and my dad said, looks like a Brooks Family Reunion, right? We worked at it. I mean, we didn't eat crazy. I mean, I knew it wasn't related to the food because we ate less than everybody else. And we ate pretty standard, and we had no soda, we had no cereals, we had none of that in the 70s. So it just didn't quite make sense. And because we were all kind of that way, and we were still successful, we were smart, we were contributory, we were smart, we were funny. And that's how I was related to even at school. So I was never kind of picked out. So that was incredibly fortunate, because if I had taken on the society vernacular that I was lesser, my outcome would have been very different. So, but because of that, I could engage in doing stuff about it and study it almost objectively as you can be in your own skin. And so I think that was a critical piece. Now, what I noticed along the way is when I graduated high school at almost 300 pounds in the 80s, which is wild, and that nobody did that. But I was in the band. I was, smart. I had a great experience. But then I went to college. My culture shifted. My life shifted. The demands on me shifted. More activity. I was in the band, so my body shifted. And so I just went on this journey of life, and I wasn't my weight. My weight went along with me.
You mentioned, and I've experienced this before, where I've worked with people who I don't see eating badly. They eat salads, they're potentially even working with a personal trainer, they're tracking their steps every day, and they're still unable to lose weight. Now, you were 100 pounds at 5 years old. That's, if I saw a 100-pound child at 5 years old, even today, knowing that we're overfeeding our children and we've got all sorts of additives and crap in our food and seed oils and all that stuff, I would still say, oh, those parents are overfeeding that kid.
It's the food, right?
It's the food. It's always the food.
It's the food.
And I've also heard a lot of debate about food versus genetics when it comes to obesity. Now, do you believe that you are genetically predisposed to having, your bones are the same size, right? So it's not.
Yeah, it's not bones. It's not bones.
Right.
No, and I can share with you what I've determined over the years. We know there's a genetic predisposition. I mean, you can look at any animal species and there are some animals that do differently than other animals, right? And humans are the same way. And prior to the 70s, 10% of the populations were obese. That is an evolutionary mandate that somebody during the famine, when everybody died, all you skinny people died off, there's going to be somebody that metabolically could survive, right? What I figured out about our family or myself is I had a genetic hiccup, iron absorption, okay? So if you start diving, there's nothing. I've studied an incredibly complex amount of things with regard to the body. There is nothing that I have studied more complex than iron metabolism, homeostasis patterns, right? Too much will kill you, too little, you just wish that you're dead, right? It's just incredibly important. And where it's not assessed, it's only really assessed in the red blood cell, okay? I mean, if you're anemic, oh, you've got iron issues. Well, let me tell you, there's a ton of iron in the electron transport system that makes ATP. So if the body's having to triage and you have a genetic hiccup in your ability to absorb iron within the gut and you don't absorb very much, right? Then your body's got to triage. All right, where are we going with this? How are we going to keep this thing breathing and warm? And so it's going to do a metabolic priority. The cell danger response is going to say, okay, we're going to make this metabolism a little bit slow because we don't have enough iron to really fully populate this.
Mm.
And so.
So it slows down your metabolism, your ability to move through food throughout.
Well,
so even if you're.
It really slows down your ability to make ATP.
Okay.
So that's your basic energy.
Yes.
Right.
Energy for the cells, for the mitochondria.
Everything.
Okay.
Right. So the ATP, I believe, is one of the biggest drivers of our metabolic balance. If you don't have enough ATP, your body's got to go, okay, we're in a crisis here. I actually think that mechanism is what really drives the whole show. And that all the nuts and bolts and tires on those assembly lines come from food and minerals. They don't come from a pill or an IV. They come from the complexity in whole foods because that's how we evolve. Now, if you don't absorb well, if you don't find it, if you don't eat it, the actual acquisition of those nutrients is a huge cultural challenge right now.
It is.
But you got to get it all the way to those assembly lines, which is deep within each cellular matrix.
Mm.
And so there's a lot of places that can go wrong. There's a lot of places drugs can impact that. There's a lot of places that And so when I kind of figured that out and saw some of that with my own journey, it led me to starting to apply that concept in helping patients populate the ATP production in the mitochondria. And that's a global thought. That's like, okay, can we get more vegetables? Can we get more protein? Can I help their gut work a little better so we absorb it? Can I make sure that they're moving enough to transport all that stuff? I hate the term exercise because I think we abuse people with that term. I think you're good if you do it and you're bad if you don't. But the reality is people that live to be 100 around the globe never exercise, but they all move.
Right.
You know, so
they're riding bikes, they're walking around their communities, they're, you know, they don't own cars.
Yeah, you look at the blue zones, they live on stairs and hills and they're mending sheep and they're taking strolls. They don't do crazy stuff, and neither did evolutionarily our ancestors.
Right?
They just had to move to live. They just hunted and gathered 6 hours a day.
And it sounds like this is the point in your story you were getting to, is that, you know, while you were in high school, you maybe weren't moving as much. You weren't diving as deep into the why. You hadn't figured out the whole iron deficiency or the iron balance issue yet, right? But then you get into college and you start to move more. There's more demands on your physical body, on your emotional body, on your brain function. And so you can start to see where the gaps are.
Well, and I also did change my eating pattern. I was eating in places where I had access to more whole foods. And so that helped a little bit. But there's one driver that I've learned in the last 10 years that is all of that. So if you have a low supply and a high demand, we got problems. Okay. Your body has to do even more extraordinary stuff. So the whole impact of demands, stress, cortisol. I study cortisol because it's a drug I hand out, right? I've got a package insert that can tell me all the nuts and bolts. Same with insulin. So I started looking at the impact of stress and demands. Now, one other thing is, this is through the 80s and the 90s. The thing you had to do to be healthy in the 80s and 90s is eat a low-fat diet.
That's right.
Okay. And that meant very little red meat, very little protein, and a lot of snack wells, you know, which were the healthy stuff, right? So, and diet soda. That's what you had to do. You had to drink diet soda because it was healthy. All were lies.
Right.
All were manipulations.
Oh,
yeah, poison.
Yeah.
But in good faith, because I wanted to be healthy and so did the people around me, we did those things in good faith. Now, if you have a low iron absorption and you're not eating any red meat, that's probably the absolute worst thing I could have done for my metabolic health.
Right.
For me personally, individually. But nobody would have actually, if I had said that to them, they would have said I was crazy. Right.
In 2025, when I talk about culinary medicine,
yeah,
and eating a whole foods balanced diet, mm-hmm, with iron, with protein, with fiber, because a lot of us are fiber deficient as well.
Oh, absolutely.
There, a lot of people look at me like I've got 12 heads because it's almost like politics, right? You can't be in both lanes at the same time. But in culinary medicine, you have to be in all of the lanes at the same time. You have to be looking at, you can't just be vegan. You can't just be a meat eater. You know, you've got to literally look at all of the different things because you're a bio-individual human who could potentially need a little bit from here, a little bit from there, more from this category. And that might change over the course of time as well.
Well, it does. Absolutely. I mean, and that's part of what I've been able to observe over the, I have patients for 33 years, right? Along with my own journey, I've also been supporting patients in their journey. And what I do know is life throws stuff at you. The variables of your life change. And I don't teach people to lose weight. I teach them to navigate their health, right? And every tool in the toolbox I want to be able to use. Now, there are some I don't want you to need, like pharmaceuticals, but if we need them, by golly, I'm right there to be help you navigate that as well. And the reality is nobody's helping people avoid that, you know, in medicine.
Especially in a role like yours.
Yeah.
It's very weird to hear a pharmacist say, I don't want you to have to take pharmaceuticals.
You know, people say that, but that's the biggest secret is pharmacists absolutely know. That is not just my thoughts. Every pharmacist knows that.
Really?
And personally, every pharmacist feels that.
Huh.
Personally. So if you have Uncle Joe and he's a pharmacist and you ask him, he's like, no, I don't want you to do that. That's what's going to happen. Now, we don't tell people that. And our professional identity has been kind of narrowed into a dispensing incentive because that's the only way we get paid. We don't get paid to tell you that. Most people do. And actually, when health practitioners became employees, and that's both physicians, nurses, and pharmacists, they in some ways stopped working for the patient.
Mm.
Because they have somebody else that tells them what their goals are and what should be done. And so the whole business of healthcare didn't become about patient outcome. It became about transactions because that's what the CEO and the accountants want. But that's at the detriment to the patient, and the patients are noticing that. So
do pharmacists also take an oath like doctors to do no harm?
Yeah, we do. We do.
So isn't this all a little silly? We are focused more on transactions and money at this particular day and age. Mm-hmm. No, that you're not specifically.
Right.
But that the industry is going in that the health and wellness industry is going towards a transactional money driven pathway. And it has been since I was a kid.
Well, that's because the cartels own it.
Right.
Okay. So that's a whole nother thing. And I'm very engaged in all of that. But the reality is I stopped working for that system. And I really have been able to stay focused on working for the patient for their best outcome. And I had to rebrand myself too.
Right.
So I'm a wellness pharmacist. I call myself that other bucket of identity because it doesn't communicate what I want or what I do. And so that's the business side that I've had to learn on branding and all that other marketing. And I know you've had to learn it too, or you actually, that's your profession. But I had to do all that just so I could help people be well.
Right.
And really that's a big part of what I'm doing now is leading pharmacy into that path. So that there's more than just me helping patients navigate this mess.
It's incredibly important. And I think that a lot of the people that I've interviewed so far are not just keeping this information to themselves. I mean, that's the whole purpose of this podcast and a lot of the other distribution, content, marketing, activation opportunities that I provide to different brands and people who I think have an important story worth sharing, which is essentially the concept for TEDx as well. But you mentioned another word that it could be triggering for a lot of people. You mentioned the cartels are trying to keep us in the same operation. Now, you don't necessarily mean, you know, the South American or the Mexican cartels. You mean more around the pharmaceutical cartels. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
I don't even mean the pharmaceutical cartels. I actually mean insurance, actually, is who I think is manipulating the dials. And they've also created a narrative in the consumer mind that insurance is health, right? And I can't tell you how many people won't engage with even a medication unless their insurance pays for it. Or they can't go to the pharmacist to sit down and talk about their medicine because insurance doesn't recognize it. So we've been groomed. I think Wall Street is the driver of most of this. We've been groomed to think health is in a pill bottle and at the doctor's office. We've also been groomed to think food is a kid's meal. And that's happened since the 80s, that human beings are being trained as to what food is from before conception, called the kid's meal, and that that is what the humans are trained to enjoy and consume, except it's just not what we biochemically need.
No.
But it has created a lot of industry, and it's also created a lot of illness for more industry.
Right. It's a self-perpetuating issue. You know, it's that, that negative loop that we always talk about in, it's not even healthcare, it's in sick care. Now, you're a wellness pharmacist that's uniquely trained, right, to manage and monitor all different types of chemistries, pharmaceuticals, but now botanicals, nutraceuticals, and food, and then stress. In order to proactively, foundationally help people optimize their health.
Yeah.
You're sharing this now with your colleagues to hopefully have them do the same. But I had a funny idea. I was actually laying in bed last night thinking about what I was going to ask you on this podcast. And I thought, you know, maybe Dr. Kathy has a trick or two up her sleeve. And I think you might, for how to shift this whole thing. Because, yes, the cartel is insurance. So if we can get insurance to pay for or subsidize the healthy stuff, the food, the botanicals, the nutraceuticals, the good things that don't necessarily have all of the negative side effects and create more disease, wouldn't that be cool? But then does that mean that our cost basis is going to go up? Who's going to pay for it? And how's that all going to work? And I know you've thought about this, so I wanted to get your perspective on how this could work.
Currently, we spend $5 trillion on healthcare. $2 trillion of that goes to insurance. Okay? That's a lot of vegetables right there.
A lot of vegetables.
A lot of vegetables. Now, all that money is actually triggered, can only be accessed by a diagnosis. So you can't even access your insurance bucket of money that you pay a ton for and your employers pay a ton for.
Right.
Until you're sick. Okay. Now, on the wellness side, which is people are paying out of pocket $1.7 trillion. So what if we just shifted $1 trillion? Into a proactive model. I asked myself a long time ago on my staff, where do people go to be well in healthcare? You know, they're going to people who have really good hearts, who may have had some self-training. You might see personal trainers, but you don't see healthcare can only be accessed with a diagnosis code. And so I'm a community pharmacy. I'm kind of accessible. I have people coming in all the time asking opinions. And so I started shifting my pharmacy to be that place, that wellness hub. And I started shifting the dialogue and the narrative as to what do we do to be well. That looked like classes. That looked like cooking demos. I've sold vegetables out of the pharmacy. I have my own line of foods and spices to help people just eat more vegetables and protein. And the reality is we have to shift our culture. And so a community pharmacy is uniquely suited and positioned. And to be honest, around the globe is the place that that begins to happen. But the current business model is not allowing for that. They actually want us out of business because our standard business has been incented by dispensing, and that's not happening. So shifting over and selling different products, having the courage to sell my time, you know, how many pharmacists do you know have an appointment to get for expertise? That took a lot of courage and therapy for me to step into that, let me tell you. But it's creating a new model. And the hard part isn't really creating the new model. It's getting the consumers to see me as a solution. Okay. Now, I've worked 33 years. I've got a really good reputation and I produce good outcomes. So locally, I've got a pretty good following. But how do I get the other pharmacies to attract the consumer for that? So, you know, as a marketing person, that's the whole game, right? So you got to do something different to get a different outcome. And so I actually think supporting and funding a community pharmacy in that way, be it through grants, be it through food as medicine, as a place to disseminate not only the products, but the information and the therapeutic connection. I think that's the model. And that's what I'm banking on the rest of my career, is I'm going to help build that model.
And building the model that is replicable across other people who are like-minded is very important and also scalable.
Yeah.
And one of the things I do know from my days in pharmaceutical advertising and marketing is that there's a lot of rules and regulations around pharmaceutical marketing. However, if you have a nutraceutical, or you're talking about food as medicine, or you're talking about some sort of community-based anti-pharma protocol, it actually becomes even more difficult to market. Because sometimes when there's rules in place, it makes things easier because you can just check all the boxes and follow all the rules.
Right.
But then other times when you don't know what you don't know, you're just saying, okay, well, this is what happened. Look at the beauty business. You can't say this skin cream made my skin glow.
Right.
Can't show a before and after in an advertisement.
Right.
It's not legally allowed in the United States.
Right.
But if you have a pharmaceutical that has transformed, you know, a very small amount of people's lives in a clinical trial, you can say that it transformed their lives if you also tell them that it's going to, you know, cause them to grow a third nipple.
Yeah.
You know, any one of those other condition sets that come from taking the medicine. I'd also love your thoughts on not just the programming, but the messaging. And I can figure out anything in terms of marketing, right?
Mm-hmm.
We can tell our stories in big mass media.
I'm
writing a lot of articles for Forbes and Entrepreneur and Wall Street Journal and a bunch of these big media. I have to be careful what I'm saying.
Yeah.
But I can give people a little bit of information on something that they can then take action on diving deeper into. But for the most part, advertising, in order to get someone to do something, to look at something more deeply, has to come from a place of fear or pain.
Yeah. And I hate it too.
So
how about hope?
The comparison of not necessarily you to other people, but you to your former self or who you want to be in the future.
Yeah.
I think that that's a little bit more efficacious. I don't know if you agree.
It is. And I love talking to you about this because, first of all, I'm a marketing hack. I'm a business hack. All this stuff has just been intuitive and I've had to dive into it. What I really love is the science and helping people empower them to a new life. But this other piece is what I had to kind of learn. And the older I get, the more I realize everything in life is marketing and branding. It really is. Who I say I am is not as important as who you think I am. So, and they are related. So we have to be careful. And that's part of actually the challenge of the pharmacist, because you got to get the pharmacist has 100% accuracy standards, right? And when I speak to pharmacists, and they're very conservative, they're very hesitant to do anything outside. And so I have to actually remind them that this is not dispensing what we're talking about, this shift. And I often say, how you get in the Baseball Hall of Fame? Well, you strike out 70% of the time, right? So you have to try. And that's the other thing with individualized care. It's not standard. So I even talk to my patients. I'm like, listen, it's not what I know that matters. It's what we discover that really is going to give us the clue and the direction and the new path for your health to emerge. The one you want. I don't even get to define that. Okay.
Well, you get to help be their guide, though. And I think that's what's really missing.
Yeah.
Is people that care. You know, you could focus on the three P's all the time, the personalized, precision, proactive care. Mm-hmm. But if you don't have an expert who's guiding you, who's willing to take risks with you to go from that, well, I don't want to work with you because I need to have 100% accuracy and, you know, it may not work out for you. But if you actually can coach people to take responsibility for their own health.
Mm-hmm. And empower. It's all about, right? To me, it's education and empowerment, embracing the journey, engaging in the struggle sometimes. It's really all of that, because that's where the education emerges and the things that really make a difference. I study chemistry, and the most powerful chemistry we have to facilitate health is first love and second food. And medicine is not dispensing any of that. Independent community pharmacy is probably the last place you can get a nugget of that. And it's threatened right now. And so what is love? Well, it's very quantum. It's acceptance. It is that journey for people and knowing that they're there. And the 33-year relationship that I have, but you know, a lot of people I've met 30 minutes ago, but that space that they can step into is so critical. Pharmacists, I have to train them in this journey because they want it to be perfect. They want the recommendation to make that difference immediately. And it doesn't always. And so you have to have grace and relationship with not only the client, but with yourself in that journey. And so that's part of the identity shift that has to happen, I think, in healthcare. What medicine hasn't figured out that with the internet, everything changed. And no longer is the doctor the one that knows the most. It really is the patient and their unique experience that is now the center. And there has to be a supportive team around that patient. And that's what the insurance and the business of healthcare doesn't want to do. Or they want to own the whole team. And that doesn't work either, because if you don't have a great hairdresser on your team, you're missing out. And if you don't have a chemistry expert called a pharmacist to help you with all those buckets of chemistry you're putting in, you're also missing out on your team. Those are big transitions that I've helped my patients with and that I'm encouraging we be there to support patients in a new way.
That's beautiful. It's great that you wrote a book about this too, because I'm sure a lot of people are listening to this podcast going, how can I work with Dr. Kathy? How can I call her? And don't worry, I'm not going to give out your personal cell phone. But you have a book that I want you to tell people about, but I want to just give you a quick anecdotal story that goes very much along what you were talking about. So I just got back from the biohacking conference in Austin. Mm-hmm. And there were hundreds of companies that had all different types of products and solutions to biohack your life, to optimize mm-hmm. your health, whether it was a supplement, a nutraceutical, a diagnostic tool, vibration, something to stimulate ATP, right? I heard the acronym ATP about 9,000 times. Hello. It's there. And then I went to go see Joe Dispenza talk. Uh-huh. And he talked for an hour and a half about regrowing limbs, curing cancer. And how did he do all of this? Through love and energy.
Yeah.
And food is energy.
Yes.
It's nourishment, not only for our body, but for our soul, especially when someone else is cooking for you.
Absolutely.
That's how I show love to my family, to my friends, is I love to cook for them. I'm praying that God gives me a little bit of a bigger kitchen so that I can have more people come in.
There you go.
But I'm sitting there listening to Joe Dispenza, and I'm looking around at all of these people thousands of people who are sitting there, whether they have come from their booth of selling their product, you know, or they've paid to be there as an attendee to learn and to gather more information. And we all have tears in our eyes because we all realize that no matter how advanced technology gets, no matter how much we rely on AI and robots to do a lot of menial tasks for us and to make our lives easier and potentially, you know, a little scarier as well, mm-hmm. AI will never love us. Mm-hmm. And we cannot, and drugs, pharmaceuticals will never mm-hmm. love us. Mm-hmm. We will never be able to transform or to optimize without love, without faith, and in my opinion, without God's love, mm-hmm. which is really the love for ourselves.
Yeah.
You're sharing so much love for so many people. It was the first thing you said when you first came on the show,
mm-hmm.
is that you spent the last 4 generations loving on people,
mm-hmm.
and learning how to love on yourself.
And being loved on.
And being loved on.
And being loved on. It's very addictive to be in this position from my own personal acknowledgement and spirit. It's hard to even consider not being in it. But as I step into the bigger space of leading my profession into this and global space, really, because what we've done with our Western approach and the Wall Street approach is we're disseminating it around the globe, and that's not good either. And it's so remarkable. I've had the opportunity this last year to travel internationally and speak internationally, and you can just still see the cultural contrasts where people still meet each other in other cultures, and their health is a reflection of that. Their good health and vibrant health and vitality is because they're connected. And because they are not isolated. And the research around isolation is just remarkable. Right. If medicine was really about people being well and lowering costs and all this stuff, they would deal with isolation and loneliness. But they're not. They're about the transactions and the dollars of healthcare. And I think we as a society, this is not going to change from the top down. It's going to change from the bottom up. The chief medical officer of the family, mamas, and it's going to change from the employer who is funding a lot of this, who is seeing their workforce get sicker and sicker and sicker. They've got to say, no, we've got to find another way. But I'm actually banking on mamas right now. I think they've got the pressure. Well, they're not being taken care of either. But they're in charge of those dollars. And they're in charge. And you said you don't like to market fear. And I'm the same way. And I'm with you. My goal is to twerk at my granddaughter's wedding. And I want to have the muscle and the brain and the physicality to be there and enjoy that. But I also need a daughter that can reproduce, that's healthy enough to reproduce, and meet some hairy-legged guy who's healthy enough to reproduce.
Mm.
And so my actions within my family aren't just for me, and it can't just be for me. It's got to be for you, too.
It has to be good for the gander, not good for the goose.
Has to be all of us.
So we are a we. That's why this podcast is called Optimize We. It's not
love it.
Play on words for Wellness Eternal, the business that this podcast comes from. It's all about we, the collective we. It's community, it's education, it's the inspiration. But at the end of the day, it's all about the love.
Yeah, I agree.
So tell us about your book.
So I did the TED Talk in 2018, and it was Obesity, the Modern Famine. And it was a very interesting experience, another exercise in what stress would do to your body, because it is a stressful process. But I felt compelled to write a book, and I started it then. And then there was this one small distraction called a pandemic, that running a community pharmacy during a pandemic was a very unique exercise in my professional career, which one of the things I did that you would appreciate is I had seen a study that said chicken soup is statistically effective against virus. Mm-hmm. So I came up with a chicken soup recipe when I was looking at all the different approaches. And you got to get, I had been talking and recommending vitamin D for 20 years prior. So I had already had my population in pretty good situation, but I thought I'm pulling out some soup for this one. And so I think I sent you guys that recipe because it's been incredibly effective and so much fun to prescribe that as a mug an hour. And I started really seeing food as an IV drip, the same way that I dose and I would correct an IV, or I would make an IV or a tablet or a suppositories. I see that dosage form of chemistry in that soup recipe. So I went through the pandemic all the while trying to grunt out this book. And so in 2024, I was able to put it in the book and get it out. And it is written for patients. It is not written for my peers at all. Now, it's cited for my peers, but it is written in a way that the same way I would communicate these concepts to somebody walking newly into my pharmacy is the same way that I have tried to write it in the book. And it basic assertion is that obesity is a symptom, and it's a symptom of starvation. Okay. And it is cellular starvation on maybe a chemistry level when I talk about the mitochondria, but it's also a starvation of love, purpose, oxygen, movement. And there's several different famines, over 20 famines that each of us may have, some worse than others.
Right.
And so it give people a concept to hopefully shift that blame and that shame that has been imposed upon them around weight, and have them look at obesity as a loving result of their body taking care of them in an environment that is incredibly toxic and incredibly dangerous. And so the way to fix it is definitely to alter the environment and to start crafting a new environment that really they get to exist in, and the byproduct of which is health, but also a weight that looks bad, that is more in line with the outcome of health. So obesity is a symptom. It's as much as a symptom as temperature or pain. Those are all symptoms of something. And I think that's the way we need to approach obesity. If we do, then we're going to see why 75% of our population is in trouble with weight. It's not because they're weak. It's because the environment has shifted so dramatically and is so toxic that is an appropriate byproduct of that.
And your book, Obesity, Discover Underlying Drivers, helps you understand the underlying drivers and navigate those core issues to see that obesity is just the byproduct. It's a symptom.
And each chapter, at the end of each chapter, are things to practice to shift that potential famine in there.
And let me book. I love an active book.
Yeah, I mean, writing a book's an interesting thing too. It's kind of very vulnerable. You put yourself out there, and I don't know how to do it any other way, but just to be out and share my experience with people.
So, Obesity: The Modern Famine.
Mm-hmm.
You can watch your TEDx. You can go to your social media, which is at Dr. Kathy Says.
Mm-hmm.
Correct?
Yes.
You can reach out. What's your pharmacy called?
It's MediCap Owosso Wellness Pharmacy and Compounding in Owosso, Oklahoma. I've been here 24 years. We are full service, and I'm here to help people be well at any stage. And if you have, I want you to have a great life. If you have stage 4 cancer, I want you to have a great life. Once you have a great life. And you should be able to.
For however long that life is.
Exactly. We want you rocking all the way to the end.
Perfect. Me too. I would love that. Sign me up.
Good.
Sign me up. Well, Dr. Kathy Campbell, I am so blessed and honored to... This is our third conversation, I think, that we've had. And every time we have a conversation, I come away with inspiration. I feel like I could go run a marathon now. I feel like I want to go cook this soup. This soup looks delicious, by the way. I love
it's fun
food. So
it's fun.
I'm very excited to try out this recipe and to check out your book, because so many of the people that I work with on the culinary medicine side are struggling with obesity as a symptom to lots of other things that are going on in their life.
Thank you. And one other thing I would add, the medicines are contributing to some of the chaos. And I do talk about that in the book. There are some categories of medicines that have put out that have been widely accepted and widely utilized that are causing the obesity problem and other health, chronic health issues. And so we've got to get straight about that, and we've got to own it. And I'm not saying they're not necessarily appropriate use, but we've got to deal with that. And I just am asking my profession to step up and be the one that does that. And hopefully we can bring medicine forward in that. And again, I'm not against drugs. I'm your expert. I'm against you needing them. So that's what we'll work on.
I love that. Well, thank you so much for being an advocate of health and doing things the way that is efficacious, true, without the BS. That's what we're all about here, too. And it's nice to have a partner that is not afraid to share that information. So pick up her book, figure out what you need for your life, reach out. You know, love somebody, love yourself, I'm just so grateful for your time here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been a privilege.